You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Milwaukee Bucks struck for at least one playoff game in protest over the recent police shooting of Jacob Blake in Kenosha. We'll talk to a WPR reporter to get the latest, and a sports historian joins us for a look at the long history of politics and athletics. First, 100 years ago yesterday, the 19th Amendment was formally adopted, so August 26th became known as Women's Equality Day. This month, we've seen a variety of commemorations of women gaining the right to vote. The USA Today Network decided to write about influential women who made significant contributions to their state and the U.S. since that time. 10 women from each state and the District of Columbia were selected and written up as Women of the Century. Kathy Flanagan is a Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter. She worked on the Women of the Century project and wrote the introduction for Wisconsin's List. Kathy, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Before we get to some of the women on the list, Kathy, can you talk about how this project came together?
Well, you know, Wisconsin actually was a year ahead of everyone else. So the Journal Sentinel had done some stories on how Wisconsin was the first state to let women vote. They did it in June of, June of 19. And so we kind of went back at it in a different way. We had a group of women get together. We brought in a couple of women from the outside to talk with us, and we looked at who we thought was influential, who probably didn't get their due in other ways. And also we looked at people like, you know, everybody wants to say Oprah's from Milwaukee, and she had some time here, but we knew that a lot of the women we looked at, like Oprah, were going to be claimed by other states. So we just started paring down from there.
And I imagine it was probably tough to pare down to just 10.
Oh, my gosh. And then since this is run, there are many, many more that probably could have been on this list as well.
Now, talk about the process and the group of people and what kind of things you weighed to get this sort of representative sampling of 10 women who were influential in Wisconsin since that pivotal date.
Well, there were about 10 of us at the table, as I recall, and everybody brought in an idea who they wanted, and they went from athletes to businesswomen to legislators, and we just looked at them. We talked about it a lot. We also talked, weighed where they were from and what their impact was in Wisconsin specifically, and that helped us sort of narrow it down a little bit. And then we sort of looked at, you know, what that means to women now.
We are talking to Kathy Flanagan from Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at 10 of the most influential women in Wisconsin since women got the vote in the Constitution in the United States 100 years ago yesterday. Well, let's start meeting some of the people on the list. Vel Phillips is one. She's kind of in a category of firsts in Wisconsin. She was the first to do many things. We could talk about that. First, I want to listen to her. She's passed away, but we talked to her on Central Time back in 2014. Here's the voice of Vel Phillips encouraging younger people to choose a life of public service to make positive changes in the world.
If you know that what you want to do is to make a better city or state or United States and to write some of the wrongs, then you should hang in there and do it and not be swayed by the fact that it hasn't been done before.
Can you talk some about Vel Phillips' story?
Well, you know, Vel has a street now in Milwaukee, which is awesome. And she was the first African-American woman to graduate from UW-Madison Law School. She was the first to win a seat on Milwaukee's Common Council. She was the first to become Secretary of State of Wisconsin and the first to become a judge, not in that order. But she proposed the Fair Housing Law in 1962, and she wanted to make it illegal to not rent to Black people, and that was voted down 6 years in a row. It finally passed the Common Council in 1968. So, you know, she was tenacious, and she also marched with Father Grappi to you know, she walked the talk. So people, I mean, her name comes up often when you talk about somebody who is quintessentially Milwaukee. It's nothing but good.
I was listening back to the interview with her and reminded of the story and kind of how humble beginnings can lead to big things. She talked about how you know, she'd been in a political organizing, a community organizing thing, and there'd been a lot of talk about an election race for not her, but her husband. And as she put it, he chickened out and said she should do it. They used money that he had been saving up to buy her a mink coat. Mink coat was out. That turned into her city council campaign money. I mean, that the story of that and then her ending up on this list, I think, is pretty profound.
That's awesome. I mean, there were when I didn't know. I mean, I knew of Val Phillips, but I've lived here 26 years and I did not know. I hadn't heard of some of these women. And that doesn't mean that their contribution wasn't well known. It just means I missed it. It's my problem. Not certainly all the women that were chosen were perfectly chosen for a reason.
I want to invite our listeners, by the way, if there's somebody you think should be on this list of influential, important women in Wisconsin over the last 100 years, you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Another one on this list, and I got to say, I only knew the name because she's been reported on by some of my colleagues here at WPR over the years, Dickie Chappelle, a.k.a. Georgette Louise Meyer, born in another Milwaukee connection here. Can you tell her story as a photojournalist?
Well, she was a photojournalist who known for her work as a war correspondent. So she covered Iwo Jima and Okinawa and then all the way to the Vietnam War. There are books about her. She's included in a book that a colleague of mine wrote, Meg Jones wrote. It was World War II Milwaukee. She sounds like an amazing person, and I wish I had met her. She died at age 47 on a U.S. mission in Vietnam. She was following behind a Marine, and he accidentally tripped a booby trap, which killed her. But before that, she'd been held as a prisoner by Russia for 60 days. And she was fearless. She was afraid of some things, but she still did it.
And one of the rare, I think you write in the piece, civilians who received military honors after her death.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, I I'm trying to remember if I read this. I didn't find it today, but I think she met Castro at one time and then she totally changed her mind about him after she saw how he ruled. But he had a specific name for her, and I want to say Spitfire, but that wasn't it either. He complimented her in her ability to go to war and to just not be worried about being the only woman somewhere or that she was a woman and couldn't do what the men were doing.
And this is another common theme, I think, among many of the women on your list, and I'm sure many others who were close to making the cut, that they were often firsts or trailblazers or groundbreaking women in one way or another. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, that's very fair.
We are talking about some of the most influential women from Wisconsin's history over the last century, a project at USA Today Network. Did this for every state and the District of Columbia, actually, to mark the amendment giving women the right to vote in the United States. Kathy, part of the team that selected Wisconsin's contribution. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about who's on the list or somebody you would have nominated, want to make the case for? You can join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now we pick up our talk with Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter Kathy Flanagan, talking about commemorating the 100-year anniversary of women getting the right to vote, highlighting some of the biggest women in the past 100 years of Wisconsin's history. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Let's bring on a caller now. Antonio is with us from Elgin, Illinois. Antonio, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Who'd you want to bring up, Antonio?
I hope that there is at least one Latina woman on the list, but I did want to suggest Christine Newman Ortiz, who has led the really important immigrant rights organization in Milwaukee for many years, Voces de la Frontera. Christine has really brought the issue of immigrant rights to the fore and third of Milwaukee's population is Latino. So I feel like she's been a really important contributor to not only Milwaukee's history, but Wisconsin's history, and has been an important female leader.
Antonio, thanks a lot for the call. As it happens, she is on the list, Kathy.
She is on the broader list. She's not on the top 10 list. But she definitely was on one of the people we put on our list to consider.
Oh, okay.
Oh, wait, I think I read the list. I'm sorry. She is. I see it right here. I'm sorry. I knew we talked about her, but yes, absolutely. She's a great asset to Milwaukee, and we're lucky to have her.
Antonio, thanks a lot for that call. And there were other people involved in various types of civil rights movements on the list. Another person, another name, Ingrid Washanawatok, born in the Menominee Nation and founded the Indigenous Women's Network. Can you talk about her story a little?
Well, she became executor of the Fund of Four Directions philanthropic organization, and she worked to revive and promote Indigenous languages. But I think her biggest claim to fame is serving on the committee as a committee chairperson for UN's International Decade of the World's Indigenous People. And she's and also co-producing the documentary Warrior. I mean, she's became the face of Indigenous people in the, throughout the country. So that's such a part of Wisconsin history. And her death was honored by the Menominee Nation with a full Warrior's funeral.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We've got some listeners emailing suggestions, some local, some statewide. Jeff in Superior says, Grace Pattison, wife of the mayor of Superior, who really helped build up the city. They built the Fairlawn Mansion and donated a lot of land to the city, some of which is in Pattison Park. You know, it'd be interesting. I bet there could be a lot of fun, Kathy, for people to do this at the local level.
Oh, my gosh, yes. I mean, we've got some suggestions, too. In fact, one man wrote me, and he had a list of probably 12 people. And it includes people like Uta Hagen, who was a well-known actress, but also theater teacher. She taught acting teacher. Or, from Charlotte Ray, who was on Facts of Life, to women who've done big, broad things that have helped their communities or the state or the world.
We also heard from Matt in Wausau, who emailed, like her or not, billionaire Diane Hendricks has had a lot of influence in our political discourse. She's been influential in her way. Thanks for that, Matt. And I think at the state level, certainly in politics, at the local level in Beloit, she's a household name for a lot of her development efforts there. Was she somebody who made the list of possibilities?
We discussed her. I'm from Beloit. So we discussed her and she did come up. I think we went with people who had that their touch was more national.
All right. Good. Thanks for the suggestion. And this is another kind of a statewide impact one. Chris in Adams nominates Shirley Abramson, former Chief Justice of Wisconsin's Supreme Court. So that's another case where probably this was somebody who had a statewide impact more than a national impact, I would guess, Kathy.
We did. We had a really long list, and it's quite impressive. It makes you proud of being from Wisconsin. But we did sort of end up with a lot of people who had more of a national impact. But certainly, yes.
Maybe it's kind of unfair of USA Today to stop you at 10. I think that might be the problem here.
You know, it could go on. And you know what is spectacular is it's a growing list. It hasn't stopped.
Let's go back to our callers now. We've got Clara on the line in Milwaukee. Hi, Clara.
Hi. I'm calling to recommend the name of Laurie Wynn, W-Y-N-N. Laurie was, as far as I know, the only black female to become head of the Wisconsin Education Association. She was a Milwaukee teacher, and she became head of the WEA. And it was during the turbulent times of this Milwaukee desegregation suit. And she played a vital role in not only the settlement of that suit, but as far as I know, she's the only black female that ever became head of the WEA.
Clara, thank you so much for suggesting that. And I'm not your editor, Kathy, but it seems like there's a follow-up here where you do people of statewide influence. Would you be open to a pitch like that?
There is, if you look at a story we had, there is a place you can nominate people. So we are taking that seriously. We're looking at the people that we, not that we might have missed, but the people that everybody knows about that maybe we don't yet, that other people don't yet.
Thanks for that call. You can find the article and I guess make nominations at the website jsonline.com, the website of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Talking to Kathy Flanagan from the Journal Sentinel, looking at this commemoration of the anniversary of women's suffrage, looking at 10 influential women from Wisconsin over the last 100 years. I want to touch on a couple more names on the list who made these national or in some cases international impacts. And this is one, again, just because I'm connected to Wisconsin public media, I know the name Mildred Fish Harnack from Wisconsin resisted Nazis in Berlin. Tell us that story.
So Mildred, who is a native, had gone to, I looked it up today. She's the only American civilian to be executed on the direct order of Hitler. But before that, she served 6 years of hard labor for crimes of treason and espionage. And there's a statue to her in Marshall Park. But it was a secret trial where Adolf Hitler had sentenced her to death. But she was married to, she met a man in college at UW-Madison, and he was German. And they went back to Germany, and they were assisting Jewish people and others targeted by Nazis, and essentially spying on the Nazi party, which is it's a brave, brave woman.
An amazing story. And now here's a name that I had heard of, and I didn't know about a Wisconsin connection until I read this article. Golda Meir, born Goldie Mabovich in Ukraine, ended up being a prime minister of Israel by way of Wisconsin, by way of Milwaukee. I didn't know that part of her story.
Her father came to New York first, but then he ended up coming to Milwaukee because he could get a job here. And after a year, he sent for his family. So she went to grade school here, and they credit her years in grade school and high school here with her ability to lead. For instance, she organized a fundraiser to pay for her classmates' textbooks, and she was always interested in teaching. And that's why there's Golda Meir School here. There's also the Golda Meir Library at UW-Milwaukee before she became, of course, Prime Minister of Israel.
Yeah, so a lot of surprising connections that we find here in Milwaukee. Well, you mentioned earlier you learned a lot that you hadn't known about people from Wisconsin. Has it given you an appetite to do more of this, Kathy?
Oh, my gosh, yes. I mean, I had not heard of I'm trying to say her, Artie Clark Halyard. I know there's a Halyard neighborhood here, and I'm not sure. I would love to know if it's named for her, but I hadn't heard of her before. And she and her husband, she was born a sharecropper's daughter in Georgia, and she and her husband started a bank for African Americans because they weren't getting loans at the time. So they started Columbia Savings and Loan, and they helped African Americans buy homes, start businesses. And I find that incredibly amazing. And I hadn't heard that story, and I liked it.
You mentioned that athletes were in the conversation. One actually made the list from Wisconsin. I'm just getting to Gwen Jorgensen, who won Olympic gold in the triathlon. Were there other athletes that were in the running for the, if you will, for the final cut?
You know, we looked at some, but it really became more about, you know, it was a really competitive struggle. And, you know, I'm sure Bonnie Blair could have fit in here. But she also wasn't born in Wisconsin. So the struggle was real. And that's why Gwen Jorgensen made it, but not a lot of other athletes that come to mind.
Time for one more caller. Anne is with us in Madison. Anne, hi.
Hi. I was thinking of Stephanie Klett, who I believe was born in Beloit and promoted Wisconsin. That was her whole career, promoting Wisconsin in many ways.
She still promotes Wisconsin. She was Secretary of Tourism in the state for a long time. That might be a possibility again, Kathy, for those people influential at the statewide level.
Right. I think she's now promoting Lake Geneva, and she was on our big list.
Thanks so much for that call. So, Kathy, you're taking nominations, you said, for people for maybe a more Wisconsin-focused list. Is there a timeline? Could we be bringing you back in the future for another conversation like this?
I have to see where I'm not really sure how this is going to work. We just offered to let people tell us. And like I said, I've gotten some really good ones. So if I can round up these women I worked with again, it could probably happen.
Kathy, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Kathy Flanagan is a Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter. She worked on Wisconsin's list of the top 10 most influential women in a century for a special USA Today Network feature commemorating the anniversary of women's suffrage. You can find the whole list and find out how to make nominations over at jsonline.com or at the national list, usatoday.com. By the way, next week we're making some changes to keep you informed and connected here in Wisconsin and around the world here on the Ideas Network. You'll find both 1A and On Point at new times on the Ideas Network, plus a few new shows and other changes on weekdays and weekends too. Take a listen and let us know what you think. You can find complete details on our website at wpr.org/fall2020. You can share your thoughts on those changes or ask questions about what's going on at WPR. You can email listener@WPR.org or call 800-747-7444. Coming up, we'll get the latest on the NBA strike, short-term strike, started by the Milwaukee Bucks in protest over the recent shooting of Jacob Blake by police in Kenosha. A lot of other teams, a lot of other leagues following the Bucks' lead. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, get a recap of the last night of the Republican National Convention and join in with your reactions to the biggest weeks for both parties. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the Milwaukee Bucks announced yesterday they would not participate in their NBA playoff game against the Orlando Magic in protest over the recent police shooting of Jacob Blake in Kenosha. The 29-year-old Blake survived being shot 7 times in the back by a Kenosha police officer. The shooting itself, the latest in a history of police shootings of black people, sparked protest in Kenosha over the last several days. While the Bucks were the first team to effectively go on strike, several other NBA teams, including the LA Lakers and the Portland Trail Blazers, followed suit. The playoff season will likely continue after these initial protests. Coming up, we'll talk to a sports historian about how athletics overlap with social justice movements and politics. First, we want to get the latest on the protests. Megan Hart is a reporter who covers sports for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Megan, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Megan, tell us the latest on what we know about the Bucks and the NBA and this stoppage. Temporary, it looks like.
Yeah, it does look temporary. As of right now, the NBA did say that they are going to host a meeting that will include the league, some key players, some members of the Players Association. Michael Jordan is in labor related to the league. Apparently, he has reports indicate he served as kind of a liaison between players and league officials and owners. So he'll be in the meeting. They're going to have that tonight and that should, or this afternoon, and that should be when we find out when play is going to resume. It looks like it'll either be tomorrow or Saturday.
The Bucks were the first team to do this. A lot of others in various leagues have followed suit. Some people are calling it a boycott, others a strike. Can you tell us a little bit about what led up to this decision by the Bucks players?
Well, on Monday, the Bucks played. They beat the Magic. And after the game, some of the players spoke to the media. George Hill in particular he didn't want to answer any questions about basketball. He felt like he was frustrated to be in Orlando, where they're sort of sequestered to play amid the coronavirus pandemic. And he was questioning what the team could do from Orlando to try to make a difference. I think after that, it came out that the Toronto Raptors and the Boston Celtics were talking about, they were talking about striking their first game of the second round of the playoffs. And then yesterday, before the game was set to begin, I think maybe some people thought it would be a possibility that Milwaukee wouldn't come out, but you know, it took a while to kind of figure out exactly what was happening. But it seems like, you know, that was the way that they found to be able to use their platform and, you know, try to draw attention to what's going on in Wisconsin from where they are in Florida.
You mentioned George Hill. He and Chris Middleton delivered the Bucks statement on their action yesterday. Middleton said with everything going on, they were unable to focus on the game. And Hill had this to say.
When we take the court and represent Milwaukee and Wisconsin, we are expected to play at a high level, give maximum effort, and hold each other accountable. We hold ourselves to that standard, and in this moment, we are demanding the same from lawmakers and law enforcement. We are calling for justice for Jacob Blake and demand the officers be held accountable. For this to occur, it is imperative for the Wisconsin State Legislature to reconvene after months of inaction and take up meaningful measures to address issues of police accountability, brutality, and criminal justice reform. We encourage all citizens to educate themselves, take peaceful and responsible action, and remember to vote on November 3rd.
And I understand members of the team actually spoke with Wisconsin's Attorney General Josh Call.
So it was a little unclear exactly what was happening after they didn't come out at 3 o'clock when the game was supposed to start. They apparently stayed in the locker room and spoke to, they called Josh Call and Mandela Barnes, the lieutenant governor, and had conversations with them about more concrete ways that they could try to bring about change here in Wisconsin. They were in the locker room for several hours after the Magic had already left the stadium. And they put together this statement that was read by Hill, and a part of it was also read by Sterling Brown, who is a Milwaukee Bucks player who's actually in the midst of a lawsuit with the Milwaukee Police Department over their excessive use of force after they used a taser on him for a parking violation.
What have we heard from other Wisconsin professional teams?
The Milwaukee Brewers, they decided to, in solidarity with the Bucks, they decided not to play their game last night. A team official said today that that decision was unanimous among the players. So they did not play last night. They are expected to, you know, to play the rest of the season as scheduled. Then today the Packers decided not to have their practice this morning. They actually screened this afternoon the film 13th for players if they wanted to come watch it. It's about the 13th Amendment, which was supposed to abolish slavery, how it actually helped lead to mass incarceration. So they're offering educational opportunities for their players and their staff and having these conversations about these issues.
Megan, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date.
Sure, my pleasure.
Megan Hart is a reporter who covers sports for Wisconsin Public Radio News. She joined us with the latest on the athlete strike that started with the Milwaukee Bucks after the shooting of Jacob Blake by Kenosha police. Now we take a look at that protest from a historical perspective. Amy Bass is professor of sports studies at Manhattanville College, where her interests focus on sport, culture, and politics. She's the author of several books, including One Goal, A Coach, A Team, and The Game That Brought a Divided Town Together. And not the triumph, but the struggle, 1968 Olympics and the making of the black athlete. Amy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Before we look back at some of the history of sports and politics, what are your thoughts on what we're seeing now? First the Bucks, then other NBA teams, then baseball, football, the NHL postponing games from today. What do you think of this moment?
I think it's an amazing moment. I think that it's yet another sort of notch in this longer history of athletes understanding that they have a spotlight and they have a voice that's pretty rare, and using it for things that they think are really important. Athletes don't stop being who they are, and what they believe in when they step on the field or the court or the ice or what have you. And we're seeing that right now.
I think there's a common thought that, hey, sports are where I go to get away from politics. Don't bring politics into my game. Has it ever been that way, or has there always been some element of politics in our games?
There's always, you know, sports are such an enormous part of who we are and what we do. And, you know, this is, I think, a particularly interesting moment because of COVID. I'm constantly arguing whether I'm writing about this or teaching about this. I'm constantly arguing that sports don't take place in a vacuum, and they never have, that they don't take place in a bubble. And right now the NBA is actually taking place in a bubble. And I think that that's actually critical to this, because we're seeing that bubble is part and parcel of society still. But even more importantly, it's this rare moment in which the teams aren't scattered around a travel schedule. All these players were in the same place, and decisions and actions were taken very quickly to put forward a collective stance. It wasn't just one athlete. It wasn't, you know, your single Jesse Owens figure or your single Jackie Robinson figure. It was all of them. And I think the bubble has a lot to do with that. And I think that that's one of the things that makes this moment really unique.
That's really interesting. I can't think of a comparable situation. All the players in an Olympic Village together or something is the closest I can think of to that bubble situation where, as you say, you've got everybody together at once.
Well, and we saw that in 68. So if you look at, you know, the 1968 Mexico City Games, Tommy Smith and John Carlos make the famous black gloved fist action during the medal ceremony for the men's 200 meters. The same thing had happened leading up to that games. The United States Olympic Committee put those athletes into what they called altitude training in Lake Tahoe to get ready for the actual heights of Mexico City, the thin air. And so you had an Olympic trials and then an Olympic sort of practice session leading up to those games where all those athletes were together in a very similar way.
Sometimes we see, as you say, individual acts of protest, and most prominently in recent years, Colin Kaepernick kneeling during the national anthem in protests of racial disparities and concerns about police violence. He's been out of the NFL since then. He hasn't had a job. What is different today than it was when he started kneeling?
Well, I think that you're seeing folks like LeBron James really sit up and start to act. And I think that there are some players who have achieved heights where, you know, what consequences are there for LeBron James to, you know, you think back to when he first put on the I Can't Breathe shirt in the wake of the death of Eric Garner, and that was at the Barclays Center. And thinking about, you know, the Instagram posts in the wake of Trayvon Martin's murder, with all of them in solidarity, the Miami Heat. I think athletes are starting to sort of think about the platforms that they've worked hard to build for themselves and how they get to choose to use them. So when you have someone like King James standing up and making, you know, creating things like More Than a Vote, working to convert sports arenas into polling places for the election, it's a force to reckon with.
We're talking to Amy Bass, professor of sports studies at Manhattanville College. Her interests focus on sports, culture, and politics, and she's with us to talk about the strikes, at least one game strikes underway by many teams across the country, starting with the Milwaukee Bucks in protest of the shooting of Jacob Blake by a Kenosha police officer, wider concerns about racial disparities. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about these decisions by teams like the Bucks to not play a game in protest? Do you think it'll have an impact on public awareness? Is this a good move on their part? Do you not like it? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the history of social justice stands by athletes after the Milwaukee Bucks' refusal to play in their playoff game yesterday in protest of the shooting of Jacob Blake by a Kenosha police officer and wider issues of racial disparities. Amy Bass is with us, professor of sports studies at Manhattanville College. You can join in with your reactions at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the decision by the Bucks, then other NBA teams and the Brewers and other baseball teams? Some practices canceled in the NFL, the NHL postponing games today. What's your reaction to these protest moves by professional athletes? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from Bill on Facebook who says, no pay then. And this is there's often a reaction. These are well-paid athletes. They're lucky to have the job. People not sympathetic to them in their protest decisions, Amy.
Yeah, you know, that's a longstanding sort of reaction that they're being ungrateful. It's a word that gets thrown around a lot, that, you know, as if that the platform that they build that allows them to have this voice wasn't created by hard work on their part too. But I think one of the keys here is that they have the support of coaches. They have the support of the league. You know, they're not striking against their employers. This isn't a boycott of the NBA. This is to use their platforms to make a statement. So, you know, there's been some debate. Is this a strike? Is this a boycott? What do we call it? Mm-hmm. And it's both. But it's again, they're not striking against their employers. And when you're looking at just how widespread this is, I mean, soccer and, you know, the WNBA has been agitating for all summer at this point on many different fronts. Tennis player Naomi Osaka sat down, you know, withdrew from a semifinal for today. So I think we've moved beyond just looking at them as workers. They're cultural icons, and we have a void of leadership right now, I think, in many ways in the United States, and these guys are stepping up to the plate.
We also heard from Michael on Facebook who says, these police shoots notwithstanding, being black in America comes with its own set of problems. Even truth is, Michael says, as famous as some of these black athletes might be, they can run the risk of being shot in public. These players are not being violent, Michael goes on. They're leveraging their notoriety to call for change. Your thoughts on Michael's comments and the way they're leveraging, he says, their notoriety here.
Yeah, I mean, they're leveraging their spotlight, and I think that's really interesting, because it's, you know, we tend to have, you know, good politics and bad politics. When is it okay to be political? When is it not okay to be political? You know, the vice president walked out of a football game famously because players kneeled, and then he refused to stand up when the Korean delegation walked in at the Pyeongchang Olympics. So, you know, some politics are okay and some politics aren't. I think that this is peaceful protest, and one of the things that tends to happen when protest takes to the streets and then might turn into some more violent movements is that we try to weaponize those protests as symbolizing something that they aren't. This isn't about urban disorder. This is about people who are frustrated. This is about frustrations brimming over in different kinds of ways. And that's not what the athletes are doing. The athletes are engaging in an American tradition of nonviolent protest. And you know, you can't have it all ways. You can't say don't be violent in your protest and then not support athletes who are not being violent in their protest.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Jesse is with us in Appleton. Jesse, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I think this is an amazing topic. I am not necessarily a sports fan, not something that is included in my daily schedule. But I think it's amazing that these players are taking their positions to take a stand, because the truth is the audience that they're going to target and be able to affect are people that may not have otherwise heard this message. And I think it's important that, you know, postponing or, you know, refusing to play really hits people where it hurts, because it changes their, you know, plan for the game, or, you know, lots of people make their social plans around games. So the idea of saying, like, hey, listen, like, this isn't okay. This is going on in our country, and you need to pay attention to it, is a really way to make change.
Jesse, thanks for the call. Do we know if protests by athletes have much influence on the fans?
You know, the fans are once removed here, and that's an interesting thing to think about. I mean, we know, for example, that the U.S. Women's National Team soccer jerseys were the top soccer selling jerseys in Nike history. We know that when Kaepernick signed with Nike, his line sold out, you know, within hours. And so if you want to sort of use a very American tool of assessment, consumerism, then yes, these athletes are wildly popular in many ways for their stances. But I think that this is interesting. Again, there's this other layer here because the NBA is in this bubble. There's no live spectators, which means this is a really low risk form of protest. There aren't vendors who aren't getting paid because the game isn't taking place. You don't have fans who need refunds. This is impacting very few people beyond, you know, the television commitment. And certainly, you know, television has more than enough to keep itself busy with right now. Everything is going on right in America right now, from weather to sports to politics. So it's interesting in terms of how we're going to gauge influence, but also this is a moment in which we're seeing, you know, very few negative consequences of these guys not playing.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Amy Bass from Manhattanville College. She researches the intersection of sports, culture, and politics, talking about the Bucks' protest, their decision to not play a game yesterday, followed by many other NBA teams, Major League Baseball as well, and a lot of other sports have done some things like this over the past few months. Back to your calls now. Susie with us in New Berlin. Susie, hi.
Hi. I am very proud of these players. I have to say I was surprised to hear it when I heard it on WPR, but very, very proud of them. And for the same reasons as the last caller, I thought she said it extremely well. They're seeing what's going on. They're representing this area. And I'm so glad that they did it. I guess that's it.
Susie, thanks for the call. Some people feeling a stronger connection with their team, it sounds like, Amy.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, one of the things that athletes have is a relationship. It's usually a fantastical or an imaginary relationship with their fans. And Jesse, the former caller, said, you know, she wasn't even much of a sports fan. But there is, you know, there's a place in the heart of cities and communities and regions, the meaning of the stadium where they play or the arena where they play, the uniforms, the logos, the mascots, all of those things mean something and you represent. I live in New York and I wear my Red Sox hat. It's a defiant statement. So you know, think about the language that we use when we talk about our teams. We lost or we won. Well, you know what? You didn't do anything, but you still get to use the we because these teams are part of who we are as a community, whether you're a sports fan or not. And I agree. I think that when you take a step back, I will say I am not a Milwaukee Bucks fan per se, but it took my breath away for a moment when the announcement rolled out on Wednesday, because it was an amazing moment of exactly what your callers are saying, standing up and saying our community is going through something and this is how we feel we must act in response to that.
You've mentioned moments, Amy, like the Mexico City Olympics. In our last minute or so, is what's happened in the last couple of days going to be something we're going to be talking about for years, maybe decades to come in the sports and history world?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we're rolling this out. Like I said, you look at somebody like LeBron James alone and his creation of the More Than a Vote movement. He is single-handedly trying to, you know, put the Voting Rights Act back on the table, working to create more polling places. He's putting money into creating more poll workers. Dodger Stadium, right, as a place that someone can vote in California. I really think that we're going to look at this moment as some powerful voices trying to make something happen, acknowledging who they are and what they can do, and just trying to shine as wide of a spotlight as they can.
And in just our last few moments, what are you watching for next?
You know, it'll be interesting. I think that one of the great things that has come out of this is how united the sports world is, that soccer's on board. The WNBA, like I said, has been on board from the beginning. Individuals like Naomi Osaka, the MLB, which tends to be a more conservative league. I'm going to be looking for the NFL. If the NFL is playing this fall, I'm curious to see what sports most conservative organizing group is going to do.
Amy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure. Good luck, Wisconsin. Our hearts are all with you.
Amy Bass is professor of sports studies at Manhattanville College. She focuses on sport, culture, and politics. Her books include Not the Triumph, but the Struggle, 1968 Olympics, and the Making of the Black Athlete. She joined us to talk about the Milwaukee Bucks' refusal to play yesterday, other teams following the suit in protest of racial injustice. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. A Milwaukee cookbook author shares recipes that are fast and healthy, oh, and tasty, too. That and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time.